Hello, you are listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. We are an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars dedicated to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about us and our programs, go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Christopher Annadale, a longtime Ciceronian, an associate professor of philosophy at Mount St. Mary's University. I'll be hosting this episode of The Sower. My guest today is Madeline Austin, the 2025 winner of the William G. Batchelder III Memorial Award for the Study of Place, which the Society awarded to her at our March 2025 conference in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Madeline lives in Pittsboro, North Carolina, with her husband Joshua. She is a graduate of the Virginia Military Institute and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she completed her MA in Political Theory in 2024. Her master's thesis was titled A Sustainable Environmentalism, Love of Place as an Ecological Virtue. Madeline is an intelligence officer in the U.S. Army Reserves and a banjo player. Also joining us today is my friend and society's stalwart, Bill Batchelder IV, professor of history at Waynesburg University. Regular conference goers will recognize Bill by his long, scary beard and his infectious laugh. The Batchelder Award was established in memory of Bill's father. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Madeline, before we talk about your work, I think we'll take a moment to discuss what the Batchelder Award is, the man it honors, and the type of work it means to recognize and encourage. Bill, tell us more about that.
Well, the Ciceronian Society is indeed an interdisciplinary society dedicated to the study of tradition, place, and things divine, and its place in particular, which drew me to Ciceronian originally, and which drew my father to one of our meetings, our Hope college meeting in Michigan in 2018. Dad was motivated throughout his political career by his love of place, this place being, first of all, Medina, Ohio, where I grew up. And of course, he knew every important person and every high achievement of anybody who'd ever lived in Medina, but also of all of Ohio. He, all his life, from the time that he was quite young, had wanted to be the Speaker of the Ohio House. And he's one of the lucky few that actually realized his life's ambition and then took joy in it. Some people realize their life's ambition, then it's a disaster, right? But he realized his life's ambition and took joy in it. He could name, not only could he name all 88 counties in Ohio, he could tell you what the courthouse looked like, who the important people were, which judge or sheriff or whoever was the person who was the most politically influential, what important person had come from there. Just an intense affection for the state of Ohio, for Northeast Ohio, for Cleveland. You know, in some ways, Cleveland has fallen upon hard times, but in some ways, Cleveland's never gotten the respect that it deserves. Medina's the next county south, but we would go up there and he could tell the stories of Cleveland during the Industrial Revolution, Cleveland during the pre-war era, Cleveland after World War II. And so this intense love of place, a really intense love of place that he focused his entire life in, which motivated his politics and his career, and honestly made him an incredibly tolerant person. The other thing that I find, you find people that are suspicious of a love of place because they believe that cosmopolitanism is where you get tolerance and humanity and humaneness. But I don't think that's the case. My father had profound affection, for example, Cleveland, even when he grew up and even when he entered politics in the late 60s and 70s and 80s, Cleveland was very much an assemblage of ethnic enclaves. So the Slovenians, there were more Slovenians in Cleveland than in Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia. And there were, you know, there were Slovaks and there were Croatians. And he, when we, you drive into Cleveland, he would point to all the different, well, that's the Greek Orthodox Cathedral and that's the Russians Cathedral over there. And that's a Presbyterian church. And, you know, that this family helped build that. And he knew all of that stuff. The truth of the matter is his love of place made him love these other places that were other people's places that they loved. I'm a inquirer in Orthodoxy. My first experience of the Orthodox Church was that he insisted that we go up to Cleveland to St. Theodosius because you have to see this. You have to see this service and this beautiful church. It's amazing. Now, if you're not from Cleveland, you wouldn't know St. Theodosius, but you might know the film The Deer Hunter. And the wedding scene in The Deer Hunter was filmed in St. Theodosius. It's had a terrible fire, unfortunately, in March, and is largely damaged. They're trying to raise money to repair it now. It's one of the real jewels of Northeast Ohio. These kinds of things, my father would know which ethnicity built which church and who was there. So not just Medina, though Medina was the center, the closest to his heart, but these places in Northeast Ohio and in Ohio as a whole. And it made him love these other groups that he wasn't part of because they were part of the place he was in. And so I think that love of a particular place is ennobling. And it makes us more human and more humane, not less so. I'm always suspicious of people that devalue place. I'm never suspicious of people that love the place they are, whether that's a dense urban neighborhood or whether that's the countryside or whether that's something in between. So because Dad so valued that, we came up with this prize when he passed away, God rest his soul, in February of 2022. And we wanted to remember him by awarding a cash prize to help support the scholarship of people who'd come to the Ciceronian Society and given the best paper on place. And so my mother reads the papers, who's Judge Alice Batchelder, who still lives in Medina, Ohio. And my sister, Elizabeth Akers, who is a very much a Ciceronian in spirit in some ways, even though she's never been there. She's a Latin Mass Catholic convert and a deep reader of Wendell Berry and people like them and intellectual. She's a Johnny. She went to St. John's, so a great books person. They both read them, and there wasn't not much question about which paper was going to be considered for the prize the year that Madeline gave hers last spring. It was immediately seized upon by both my mother and my sister. So yeah, we were, and my dad would have liked this paper as well. So yeah, this was something that everyone enthusiastically agreed deserved that prize.
Great, thanks, Bill. Let's turn to talking about the paper now. Madeline, the paper that you submitted that won the award was drawing upon environmental virtue ethics and agrarian political thought to unite the concepts of storge and agape in a new account of love of place. How would you sort of introduce this to people who didn't see or read your paper back at the conference in March?
Yes, thank you, Bill, for the. I'm very honored by what you said about your family liking the paper. That means a lot to me. I am very interested in these environmental questions, and virtue ethics and kind of virtue-centered philosophy has always appealed to me. Maybe if you want to put it at odds with kind of a more analytical philosophy. And it seemed to me also that the people asking the most interesting questions about the environment, if you want to call it that, nature, natural world creation, etc., were in environmental virtue ethics, or environmental ethics more broadly. There's this kind of hesitation to focus any sort of environmental accounts in the mainstream academic conversation and popular conversation because of this suspicion of humanity. We caused the problems. So there's this idea that we can't possibly do anything about them. We are intrinsically just bad for the earth. And I thought that environmental virtue ethics, focusing on the character of people, actually provides some really interesting conversations that bolster against this kind of this technocratic tendency of mainstream environmentalism to say, hey, the only way we can do anything about this is from the top down. It's got to be big. It's about money, you know, an individual person or a community. You can't have an impact on that. And I've really seen how that's led to especially young people being either anxious or apathetic. They say we can't have children because that would not be a responsible thing to do. So it's motivated well, but when you get to that place of anxiety or apathy and you don't do anything, then you're really in trouble and the world's really in trouble. So I was trying to figure out a way to explore this topic, and I think place is a very important answer to this, and I've been inspired by so many Ciceronians, but also Wendell Berry, my favorite environmental book is Roger Scruton's Green Philosophy, also known as How to Think Seriously About the Planet. And I really wanted to continue in that line of conversation. And so there were two things that didn't seem to, they seemed to be related, but I couldn't find any already established connections between them. And this is the kind of virtuous sense of love, as in love as an action, love as in the Christian sense of to love one's neighbor, which is not really dependent on emotion or feeling. And then this sense of affection that all the agrarians talk about, Wendell Berry, it's all turns on affection, where Roger Scruton talks of oikophilia, love of home. And this is more of a feeling. And so I wanted to draw on these two traditions, love as a virtuous sense, agape, and then love as a more emotive thing. But I wasn't sure what how to combine those two. And then once I reread Lewis's Four Loves, I kind of remembered about the forgotten love, storge. If you ask people what are the four loves, they can pretty much give you the three, and then they're not sure about the other one. And I was like, that's the one I'm looking for. So that we can talk about that more, but that essentially that combination between virtuous love and affection is really what drew me to this idea of love of place as the root of a more humane environmentalism for an ordinary people.
That's great. If I could ask you a Storge question right out of the box, what how would you defend Storge as part of your system against people who might say that it has a certain kind of generic and pre-ethical character? So if it's just affection for whatever you're used to, well, then anybody can get used to anything, and there's no particular reason for anybody to love anything other than the fact that it's theirs. And that's only in the case if they've actually stayed in one place for a long time, that they have a sense of place. Where people are mobile and cosmopolitanism seems to be the place where you can sort of have a variety of experiences, leave behind the old affection for place, and maybe rise to a sort of higher ethical sensibility. How do you push back in defense of making concern for place and the objects of affection a key part of this virtue ethics sense of place?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing is that, like the virtues themselves, you can't just have one virtue. You can't just be a courageous person and kind of be set for good moral character, that you kind of end up unbalanced, right? You need this prudence to guide which virtue is required in particular circumstance. And in that same way, storge alone is a double-edged sword, and Lewis argues that really it ought not be alone, because it's not receptive to the qualities of the beloved, let's say. So you can have affection for people who don't really deserve it, or places that don't really deserve it. Kind of like the example that Lewis uses, and that's most resonant to me, is the grumpy neighbor. If you've been around the grumpy neighbor 20 years, you're kind of familiar with her ways or his ways. Even if you don't love them in the same sense you might love someone more agreeable. Now, what's important there, which this is why storge ought to be tied to a more virtuous sense of love, which is choosing to love the other even when it's difficult. I think the combination of those things hedge against kind of the weaknesses of one or the other, because if we totally rely on virtue for an account of the environment, we're in trouble in a practical sense, because no system totally reliant on virtue, unfortunately, tends to be quite realistic. And so I was looking for this other element. So when virtue fails, perhaps we can hope that this affection for our place in particular, but also other things, can step in. And when our affection, we're not quite feeling that, because you can't really force it, you can't choose it. It arises naturally, or maybe not at all. So you can only encourage it. When that's not there, then you could choose the loving action. So they're kind of reciprocal. So just how prudence kind of orders the virtue, those together kind of form what I'm talking about with love of place.
That's a great answer. Thanks. I really appreciate that. How do you think mainstream environmentalism would change if it actually acquired more of this love of place, apart maybe from scaling down from large-scale international political solutions down to community solutions? Is there something more humane about it that you think would actually benefit the environmental movement and make it more sustainable in itself as an environmental movement?
Yes, absolutely. That's why I'm so interested in this term of sustainability. I kind of feel like I get the sense that the system that we're operating on, the kind of environmentalism you get from the news, it's inherently top down, as we talked about. It tends to be kind of left wing or progressive, if you will. It has a very particular character. You're expected climate change is sometimes totally synonymous with it. It's very much an ism. For some reason, a lot of people who would call themselves Republicans are not as interested in that. And it seems to be a very left-wing dominated thing and always big, always big. I don't think necessarily that that's bad or we don't need that per se, but I think that it's so dominant that it's really flushing out any other ways to think about this. And that's why I think that this approach, this messaging, which I think is fundamentally a framing issue, says there's no other way to do it. You're both responsible for these things that you cannot change, and you should feel guilty about it too, though, even though you're told you can't do anything about it. So that lack of agency, I think, is really damaging to people who really want to make a difference, if you will. I'm literally saving the world. I'm not so sure, but you sure can do a lot where you are. So I think having the proper framing can help. But I think we need some big things to deal with big problems. But I think this dominant message that the big things are the only way and the only problem is really damaging for ordinary people.
Do you think there's a way that smaller communities, I'm thinking especially myself as a resident, longtime resident of rural communities, that there's a way that rural communities, that small communities can acquire another kind of agency, some additional political agency in terms of dealing with environmental problems in their vicinity, that this isn't just about the virtue of individuals, but of places, of people, of pueblos as well?
I think that's absolutely right because of the dominance of this kind of technocratic framework, we have this issue, and Sir Roger describes it as bigger entities essentially confiscating both problems and solutions from smaller ones. So if you think about the Catholic principle of subsidiarity, right, that problems and things should be dealt with at the lowest level appropriate for their care. So the standard operating procedure, if you will, is to go from the bottom to the top. We've kind of inverted this where we start with like, oh, the big entities, they have the most power, they can be the most efficacious. And it's very reasonable at first glance to say, well, this is an organization that has the most power, it should deal with the problem. But we get into a lot of problems this way. I don't think that's a controversial statement for the Ciceronian society. But I think returning the sense of agency to communities is really important because the first step is an idea of, wait, this is our place. This is the place that we live. We can tangibly see what needs to be done. Ideally, and we could talk about how to develop this, but you know what needs to be done when you know the different churches in the area, like Bill was talking about, when you know those stories, just in the same way, when you know a person, sometimes you get a sense for how to best treat them, how to best talk to them. You get to know them. I'm not saying that all the time you know what's best for them per se, but it certainly helps to kind of know who they are. And I think that in returning the sense of, hey, this is the place we know best and we're actually best equipped to deal with these problems in front of us is a really powerful way to kind of get the ball rolling and just add another dimension to the conversation instead of saying, well, we just need federal funds to do all these things locally, and just get the sense that we really can make changes and we can also protect good things that we already have in our local communities.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I agree. It almost seems to me like there is something kind of like a paradox of subsidiarity. However, if small actors, small communities already had the agency and the power to identify and solve their problems, we wouldn't be talking about trying to return that power to them. We're in a case where they've already been, in a sense, kind of bulldozed and have too much taken from them. I'm reminded also of my flashback now in my mind to the last Sower episode I hosted on my own, which was my interview with Rachel Ferguson about block-to-block revitalization of inner city communities, which was this exact same thing, the sort of telescopic philanthropy, the airdrop of massive money, federal money into communities wasn't doing it, but people who know this block, this family, this people, these people, this kid, they can help make all the difference. So, Bill, I wonder if you'd like to get in on the conversation here on either the theoretical or the practical level.
Well, I remember when I introduced her paper to Ciceronian in March, speaking of this sort of this question of scale and so forth, I'm often reminded by the sort of really large scale people that put themselves forward as representatives of environmentalism. You think of somebody like Bill Gates or someone like that. Very often they remind me of Rousseau saying that he's a great lover of mankind, but individual men, he just doesn't understand them at all. You associate people like that with flying around at conferences where they can figure out how to coerce other people, but you don't really picture any of them in a particular place. And what they're doing doesn't seem to be motivated by that at all. I was delighted at the, I mean, obviously it's a terrible story to tell, but it was perfect timing. The week that Madeline gave that paper, there was an environmental summit in the rainforest, and so they had massively destroyed hundreds of acres of rainforest so they could have the meeting in the rainforest. If that doesn't epitomize the global version of environmentalism, I don't know what does. But I wonder if you want to comment on that kind of Rousseauian "mankind I love, but man, I know him not" version of environmentalism.
Yeah, is that to me, Bill?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I do see a lot of Rousseau, good and bad, in these conversations, and in particular this whole utopian idea, and of both man and city or state, that we can create the ideal society. And again, while the motive I do understand, I'm deeply skeptical of, at least by itself, that these ideas lead to both individual and community flourishing, but also kind of a more large scale flourishing. I'm also reminded, I think it's in Brothers Karamazov, where I don't know if I can't remember if it's Zosima or I always mix that. I think it's someone quoting someone, but he says, "The more I love man in particular, the more I hate man, or the more I hate man in particular, the more I love mankind, and the more I love mankind, the more I hate man in particular." I can't remember what it is exactly, but it's that my friend Matt Young, he always quotes at me. I'm like, yes, exactly. This kind of rejection of the particular as well, it's kind of summed up in this slogan of think global, act local is often, at least in our circles, villainized, but outside of our circles, it's actually very popular. A lot of the people that I thinkers that I work with, like Wendell Berry, Roger Scruton, they're like, no, you can't think global. That's not physically possible. So for me, the biggest tension is this idea of the imperfectibility of man versus utopia, and then this more abstract, this abstraction of people in this utopian way to think about it, or if we just blow everything up and we just need to start over, or it's just your money that we need, we don't need you as a person. This overemphasis on humanitarianism and philanthropy, which are not bad on their own, but it's kind of like an excess or a deficiency. It gets to a point where it's we need something else.
Madeline, is there anything of a kind of critique of liberal individualism, of the sort of the liberal vision of the person in any of your work? Is your return to virtue in part a critique of the sort of isolated individual of certain kinds of political theory?
That's a good question, and one that I'm kind of continuing to think through and wrestle with. On the one hand, I'm very sympathetic to the principle of variety that goes on in liberal theory, but I do think that an over focus, again, everything in moderation, I think an over focus on the individual is not good. And I'm very intrigued. I've seen a lot of presentations at the Ciceronian Society conference. I can't remember in particular who's presented on this, but this myth of the individual. And this is especially interesting to me because when I read Edmund Burke and Roger Scruton, for example, it's in a very British context. And it's very interesting to think of their ideas in the American sphere with the American history of individualism. And I'm trying to reconcile that right now. So I'm going to wait to see how these conversations develop a little bit more. But what I will say is, in either direction, I think there are liberal ways to think about this, and I think there are more, I guess, what pick your poison, communitarian, distributist ways to think of these things. But I think moderation in either way is good. I'm not necessarily for like we all go to hippie communes, but I also don't necessarily want to do away with community in the way that kind of this excessive emphasis on the individual in liberal theory might have us do.
Can you relate some of what you've been saying? In particular, you invoke in your paper Wendell Berry's concept of wholeness. Can you maybe relate some of what we've been talking about to that concept of wholeness in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. So I really found myself wondering about how do we think about the environment? And again, you both probably are aware of the debates of whether the environment is the proper term, but I do tend to use that term because it's the most recognizable in and out of our circles. But be that as it may, this idea of the environment, it's so big. We're talking about the whole world. Sometimes we kind of talk about the cosmos when we talk about escaping to Mars and things like that. So that's a lot. And because that's so big, the human mind cannot adequately and particularly deal with that scale. Like we cannot even imagine. We can only kind of deal with these slices at a time. So what do we do in environmentalism, environmental political theory, which tends to be pretty interdisciplinary? You have the scientific portion, political theory, all that. Is we divide it by topic. So you'll have like animal ethics, let's say, or you'll have trees or seeds or soil, pollution, climate change, these kind of topical problem-centered typically problem-centered topics. And I wondered if we could have a different framework to think about that, what would that look like? And to me, in my reading of Wendell Berry, he offers this really valuable and really simple way is just lower your scale. You need to consider the whole, but you need to think of a smaller area. And when we talk about the environment, I think this is crucial because we're all familiar, even from just a simple ecological and biological sense, everything relates to one another. And you can't really isolate one of these variables. It's very easy to over-isolate where you're not really considering the whole. We've heard about what was it, the so-called dire wolves of last year, and this idea of when a species goes extinct, it ripples throughout the ecosystem. So I'm really interested in instead of looking at these questions in a topical way, what if we looked at a whole ecology in a smaller sense? So for example, perhaps you have a park that you know. If you're just thinking about the health of your park down the road, you can consider, is there litter in the park? What's the water like? Does that need a cleanup? What are the things going on there? What do the people enjoy doing there? What kind of animals, flora and fauna are there? Whereas, and if you're kind of taking the more typical approach, you're thinking about how do I clean up all the plastic in the ocean? How do I clean pollution? How do we deal with climate change? So I'm really interested in this kind of movement of scale because I believe when we talk about these topics, it just seems that isolating things it isn't very helpful.
So I guess one of the questions that I would follow up on, not that you necessarily have to have all the answers, but because it is a hard thing to think about if you want to start at local first, is what do you do about areas that have largely been sort of powerless in the face of other people externalizing their costs on them? So, I'm in a federally designated county of Appalachia, and I think of all in the United States, those counties are the most notorious for having had other people's costs externalized onto them. We lost an entire park in my county because it was undermined, and they lost the lake. I mean, the park's still there, but it was supposed to have a lake. The lake fell into a mine shaft, basically. And when the state came out, they just sort of they penalized, my understanding is, they penalized the mining company responsible, then came out to the park and said, shrug, I don't think this is fixable. So the state just ended up with the money, not the local people, and the local people lost their park. And in some places that I've lived, there'd be pitchforks if that happened. But around here, that happens. If you're trying to be locally focused, but local people are largely powerless, again, this is an ongoing problem. This isn't some, I mean, if this could be solved, Appalachia would look different.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you think about that conflict between, on the one hand, wanting to be very local, on the other hand, those people being deprived of their power, what reflection do you have on that?
Yeah, that's a really tough question, especially because a lot of my research is trying to address this despair, of the mainstream environmental movement. It is also very true that there's a despair when you watch your own town being destroyed. Pittsburgh right now is undergoing incredible, devastating growth, frankly. I won't get into that too much, but yeah, that is a challenge. I'm not sure, but something tells me that the place to start is with the things that you can do. And sometimes that's not a lot, and that's a great tragedy. And it's really hard, especially not to lose hope in those cases. But I think this apathy definitely is tied to the sense that there's nothing I can do to change it. And when that's a cultural thing in a particular community, perhaps because bad things have happened before, the mountain has crumbled from strip mining, or the park's been taken away, or the development has just gotten rid of all this historical farmland, that's really hard. And I think Vandana Shiva actually has some great commentary on this. She talks a lot about, and I might be wrong on the particulars, but I hope I get the spirit. Learned about her from Dr. Norman Wurzba at Duke. Vandana Shiva talks about the intellectual property of seeds. Essentially, what has happened, a lot of these large companies, you're familiar with some of the big players like Monsanto and things like that. Essentially, they come to India, they tell some of the local farmers where she's from, they say, hey, we can genetically modify your seeds, your traditional seeds that you use. We can make them more efficient, and you'll see a reduction, you'll see an increase in growth, less disease, and you'll have more crops. Sounded great to everybody. So the seed saving, give them to the company. The company then puts a patent on their technology and then begins selling seeds to the local people, instead of this traditional method. So I think the first thing to do, when you find yourself in a grave, the first thing to do is maybe stop digging the grave. Is find a way to at least communicate the power that people do hold. And that's really tough when you're facing things like starvation. a lot of the most interesting parts of this conversation will have to do with these industrializing countries that are becoming perhaps overly dependent on the Western world, or the, what do they call it, the global North or whatever. And the key is, like, can people stop themselves when these things are on the table? Like, what country is going to reject industrialization? And not only that, but then you have these countries like the United States, these wealthy countries, then trying to impose environmental regulations on these countries in ways that they did not have. So these are really interesting questions. I don't have a ton of insight to the answers, but I'm really curious in these stories like that Vandana Shiva tells about, can local communities take hold of what agency they do have, or is that a pipe dream? I'm not sure.
Madeline, I have another question for you. Are we, could we say, based on your work, not merely that the environmental movement would be helped by and should make room for this kind of place-based, virtue-based focus in its work and in its the understanding of people to give hope to people who may feel like can't affect global solutions at all. But are we approaching a principle that might apply to everybody, which would say people, every person should be loyal to their place, should have a sense of rootedness and place. And if they don't, in some sense, the people who are now most empowered and privileged by the current way we are thinking about the environment would in fact be perhaps the least so. If they lack a place, if they are a sort of traveling with, what's the word I want? Not mendicant. Itinerant is the word that I want. Kind of itinerant intellectuals or government officials. Is it the case that we're moving towards a normative principle that love of place is a thing that really should be part of the well-lived human life? And people who lack it are not only lacking in their effectiveness to advocate for the environment, but just lacking in a general sense.
I think so, and it's Sir Roger who describes this in a really eloquent way at the end of Green Philosophy. He says that a healthy environment is an effect of strong community, and so we see all of these problems come stemming from weak community and a weak sense of place. And there are some clear enemies of love of place. So you mentioned mobility at the start of the episode. That's a really tough one that I want to deal with more head on in the future. Because at the end of the day, you can't, a crucial ingredient for storge, this affection for your place, is time. You need time for it to develop, and if you don't spend the time in a place, it's very hard, because you can learn to love an even a difficult place. But it takes some time. And right now we are set up to minimize or sometimes hate the places that we are. And sometimes there are several authors, especially in the Front Porch Republic, who have been talking about, well, what if a place doesn't seem to be worth loving? And that's a whole nother conversation. But there are a lot of places that are becoming more ugly. But I think for me, the most important part of this is that all places are to some degree worth loving. And that is primarily because of what you said. I think it's, at the risk of using the word natural, I think it's a natural human desire to have an affection for one's place and an attachment, a rootedness to one's place. And I think we can point to that because we feel something's wrong when it's missing. I didn't quite realize I grew up mobile. I was definitely part of. Yeah, I've been part of that generation of, well, we can go anywhere, so we can, and there's opportunities. And it's always a trade-off. I'm not saying, you need to just like that's always your highest priority. Again, returning to prudence, ordering the virtues. Sometimes you need to weigh love of place against other things. But I didn't understand why I became so upset as a child, leaving a home that I loved so much. And I thought, oh, well, that's just childish, you'll grow out of that. But you sense that place in your mind and in your memory. And I get the sense that there's this intuition of place is important. And I think our neglect, our large, big scale cultural neglect of place hurts us. And I think each of us can feel that in some way. It's missing for us. And so that's why I think it's at least worth taking a closer look at. And my big goal so far with my research and what I've found, if I could advocate for anything with it, is that, there are complicated questions in loving our places because each place is a place. It's not all place. And there are sometimes, you can kind of be in an abusive relationship with a place. Sometimes you can't leave a place. And that's part of why I think loving your place, no matter where you are, is important. Love is a difficult concept sometimes. But if I could say anything to anybody, it's at least have place as part of your consideration. I don't even think we allow for that. I think we even discourage, like, don't consider if you're a student leaving for college, don't consider the place that you came from or what the people there will lose. Or don't consider when you leave a place, you leave behind people that you knew, and those attachments will not be the same. That's just, I think, a fact of life. So if we could just have it part of the conversation, I think that would be very, very helpful in this mobile world.
Certainly sounds like a good start. I think that what one of the hazards here, one of the difficulties, is certainly that a lot of the intellectual life, including our three lives, in the US today is very much tied to the universities, and universities are themselves, it kind of paradoxically, right? They're situated in a place, and so when you're committed to a university, you're of that place, but you've almost certainly not come from that place, nor have most of your students. So virtually everybody, every person who makes up the place, is sort of a late adopter of the place, and yet the place is meant to be, you know, very important to the alumni, especially to the longtime professors and students as well. So there is something odd about that in the way in which the economic factors and social factors that influence the way the kind of intellectuals that we become have put us in both sort of rooted in and alienated from our places of origin.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah, and it's a very sad reality. In my more noble moments, I like to think of it as a sacrifice, for the sake of, again, this ordering of things. I would really deeply like to be rooted in a place forever. And this is also why, I think it's important right now. This is why I've kind of taken Sir Roger's concept of Wikifilia, love of home, and adjusted that a little bit, because I think there's more to home than place. We're all in place, and those places change sometimes, and sometimes you have to order a higher value than love of place. But currently, love of place or place ranks like really low, it seems. And I think, especially with young people who are deciding maybe what to do after college or what to do after high school, they're almost discouraged from staying at home. That's like a negative thing. We get this sense of you should go off and make your own, and maybe you come back, but that's kind of frowned upon. You failed if you return back. And I think if the conversation allows for a little more room for that option, or just tell people it is an option, actually, I think that could have a big impact. So perhaps that's a little a modest goal, but I hope it's a good one.
I appreciate that. I do wonder. I don't want to say anything radical, but it does feel to me like the social and economic realities of the country would have to be rather different from the way they are now before you would have a significant number of people, and even more so for a significant number of the elite, to actually have a lifetime or half a lifetime's experience of being deeply rooted in a single place. I mean, the mobility seems to be kind of built into the American character, and something we make our peace with, and we struggle to sort of elevate the ranking that we assign to place now, and probably, you know, in the foreseeable future for any of our lifetimes. But it certainly doesn't have to be that way, hasn't always been that way, and we can think outside the box.
I think that's true.
Close to wrapping up the episode, are there any final thoughts from Bill or Madeline, anything you'd like to bring into the conversation before we go?
Bill, I drove through Ohio for the first time recently, and I did it actually like 4 times in a month, and so I felt close to you as I was
Which part of Ohio did you grow up here?
I was going up to Michigan, so it's actually I'm not very well oriented as I was going through the map, but I started in the bottom right, and I curved up.
Went
I was
past
on that.
Columbus.
Yes.
I lived there for years. I love Columbus. It's a
There you
wonderful
go.
town.
Made me
Yeah.
feel close to you.
It's sad, of course, that you had to go to Michigan.
Didn't think of it
We're
that
mere 8 days away from Ohio State, Michigan, but we will be required to hate Michigan with all our hearts.
The heart of it all. Ohio. That's shout out to my friend Tyler, who's also a tried and true Ohio man.
It is, I always tell my students when I teach American history that it's the heart and center of Christendom.
Is the kind of claim that love of place will stoke.
Well, I'm very glad that we got to this interview, and I apologize for the delay. I'm forever doing something or other. It's been a while since we gave you
That's
that prize, but
good.
I'm so glad that we were able to do this.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to talk to you, and I really appreciate the consideration for the prize and winning it. I'm very, very honored by that. And the idea that your family read my paper is very exciting,
We
because
loved it.
it's the
So
most
they,
readers I've ever probably gotten.
well, they loved it. So, and Chris, thank you for putting this together. We
Thank you, Chris.
do appreciate the opportunity.
No, this has been a lot of fun. I'm glad we got together. I got to have this meeting and this conversation, and I'm anxious to Madeline to see what kind of work is going to be coming from you in the future on the topic of place and virtue. especially. It's just one of those topics that I think that needs a whole lot more academic attention and sort of pushing it out into the social space where young people especially can be affected by it as they're thinking through their identities and what looks to be a fairly unsettled time culturally for us in the remainder of this decade and probably the next decade as well.
And did I hear you say, Madeline, that you will be at the Omaha conference this March for Ciceronian Society?
Yes, that's right. So last year I heard Annie Crawford deliver a marvelous paper on the Ransom Trilogy, and Josh Herring, who most of the listeners will know, the man is everywhere.
Oh,
He
yes.
asked if I'd be part of a panel, and I said, well, yes, I guess so. So I'll be discussing c competing ecological visions in that hideous strength in particular.
Oh, excellent. I look forward to that.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you. Will you be there?
I will. I'm on a panel which is considerably less completely less morally responsible. We're doing a panel on Lovecraft, and they were one short, so
Very cool.
they asked me to make up numbers for that one.
I
So
look
I'll
forward
be on the
to
Lovecraft panel.
Well, that's fantastic. I feel like I'm looking at the two opposite ends of the spectrum here. Well, thank you both for being here. My guests today on this episode of The Sower have been Madeline Austin and Bill Batchelder. Thanks very much to both of you for appearing. You've been listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. If you like what you hear, please like, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. We hope you'll take the opportunity to find out more about us at ciceroniansociety.org and consider joining us at our March 2026 conference in Omaha, Nebraska. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.